everybody. We are live now after a terribly terrifying moment of technical difficulty.
That was really nerve-wracking. That was really...
It was horrible.
It was a bad way to start. My lighting situation is pretty horrible, too.
Lighting and much terror was happening.
Yeah. We're still futzing around, figuring out a couple of tiny... I don't know what's wrong with this web camera.
I'm so embarrassed.
Does it look all weird on your end and kind of blurry?
You look fabulous.
I look crisp and in high definition?
No, it's a little bit, it's a little fuzzy.
It's a little fuzzy. See, that's really weird. If I shine it right on me, does that help?
We're gonna get this figured out.
We're gonna figure it out. Well, fuzzy or not, I'm here and I have your attention.
And this is the first of 500 episodes of two brothers talking about food and movies.
Well, the 500 that we've got all in the Bible so far and worked out.
Right. But I think, we have my audience is here, and I know that your audience is here.
So no doubt.
I'm going to start by introducing you to my audience, because they don't know you.
Makes sense.
They don't know you. Well, this is my brother, Anthony Arkin. He is a filmmaker, started at the age of 8 with his very own production of The Hunchback of Notre Dame, which he did. It's his own adaptation of the novel into a screenplay. And he also directed it and had a crew of about 15 people working on that thing and a cast of probably 25 people, and we shot it on location. I think it's probably the biggest production that an 8-year-old has ever run.
It's the biggest production that Chappaqua ever saw.
Right. And then he went from that, the other highlights of his career, the mockumentary State of Rock, which he wrote, produced, and directed, and edited, because he's an amazing editor. And most recently, his sci-fi thriller Sender, which he wrote and directed and co-produced, right?
One producer, he did all the producing work. I directed and co-wrote. All
you did was write it and direct it.
That's all I did. And
you shot it too, right?
No. I had somebody else, much more technically.
All you did was write it and direct it.
All I did. And I acted a little bit. That's it.
And then that was just in the Boston Sci-Fi Film Festival.
Yes.
Also an editor extraordinaire, an actor, and a voiceover artist. You may know him as the voice of Wendy's and as the affable travel agency employee Stavos on the hit series The Americans. I know him only as my sweet baby brother who asked me to fix his Tickle Me Elmo. And that was just last week.
That was, yes, I have no comeback to that because it's just true. It's simply true. So for the people that are watching who know me but don't know my brother Matthew, Matthew has been my brother since I was born. Since the time I was born, Matthew's been my brother.
That's true. And I can't say that about you.
Well, technically, no. Technically, you can't. But that's not even what I was driving at. I just meant, like, I don't know a time or place where you're not my brother. So to frame kind of what our relationship is like, you've never left me alone. And I don't know, like, when I'll get some free time. Matthew, among other things, is a co-star, at the very least, of television and film and Broadway and off-Broadway. He has worked with some extraordinary people, including Telly Savalas. I want to hear some stories about that.
Oh, wow.
He's worked with Jack Klugman and Tony Randall on some very, very, very theatrical events in New York on Broadway. He's very well known in New York for a production of a play called Dinner with Friends, in which he was brilliant, and it was a show that ran for a very long time here in New York. He's also done a ton of voiceovers and a lot of television recently. I think Get Shorty was the last thing somebody might have seen you on television. But you were just recently shot in something in a doorway. And I forget the show that was.
No Minds. Basically, all I did was say hello and then die.
Which you did really well. And Matthew is also a novelist, an excellent novelist. He wrote a fantastic thriller. Which we also probably talk about a bit. And he's also a great teacher of acting and film. And I'm kind of new to that game too. So we've been talking about that a lot lately as well. Are you drinking any beer or anything during this? Are you?
You know, I don't know the YouTube rules about having a beer live on television. I don't want to. I would love to have a beer. I think we need to find out about that. If okay. there's anybody out there watching who can go online and do some research for us and let us know whether we're allowed to have beers, we'd certainly be.
We could. That would be helpful.
I also, you know, I forgot to mention that you are an acting teacher as well with your amazing wife, Amelia Campbell, who's also an incredible actor, and you teach both privately and at Pace University.
Yes, and at Primary Stages ESPA in the city.
That's right. Yeah. My friend Sid is telling us that we can drink. Are you absolutely positive? We don't want to get arrested or banned from YouTube, Sid. He says that he has researched it.
I'm fairly certain that if you put a beer or something like that into a glass, it wouldn't be, how, who would know?
Okay. Well, then, you know, what we have to do is we have to come up with something to do. I have to come up with something to do while you go and get something.
Mm-hmm.
So I can entertain people. And then you have to entertain them while I go get something. And then, but it's worth sticking around because as soon as we come back with our beverages, we are going to start talking about Misery, our own, and the movie.
Mm-hmm. Mostly our own.
Yeah. And then we both have some stories about James Gunn to tell.
We do.
Kind of funny.
Maybe Rob Reiner as well. Maybe.
My friend Sid is promising anything. Don't show the label.
Thank you. That makes a lot of sense. That's what you'd do if you were shooting a movie. You would just wouldn't show the label.
So you go get something. I will answer questions from the audience while you go get something.
And I'll be back in a jiffy.
All right. So my friend, while Tony's going and getting his beer, my friend Joe Brancato, who runs Penguin Stage Rep. Penguin Stage? Is that correct, Joe? An amazing director. He is mentioning that Tony is a terrific stage actor as well. He is. He was in the wonderful play Waverly Gallery. And he was in a play at, oh my goodness, I'm forgetting the name of the play that my father wrote.
I hope that wasn't as long as it felt like that took forever.
It did. Joe Brancato is saying, drink, get arrested, it will raise the series profile.
That's I've always said that the bad publicity is better than the good publicity, right?
Can you see the chat scrolling by on the screen there?
I can see Joe Brancato said that.
Okay, so you talk to the people and answer questions while I go pour myself a beer.
All right, fantastic.
All right.
I'm misspelling imbibing at this very moment. Imbibing. I am. Drinking. That's probably what I should say. This is very awkward. I've never really been staring at an audience of either Joe and I don't even know how to tell how many people might be here. Somebody else was recommending that we start drinking, which was great. Very good idea. And then Joe also felt that I should start drinking. So far, that's two votes for drinking and no dissenting opinions on that so far at all that I can see.
I'm back, and what I'm doing is I am not showing the label, and I'm drinking it out of a coffee mug. That's got to be safe, right?
Well, you own the rights to that, so and you're not going to get in trouble.
A novel coffee mug, so. Okay. Misery.
Well, did you have a preamble about it? Because I have a starter question.
Okay, go. You would say Misery, James Caan, Kathy Bates.
1990.
Kathy Bates. Rob Reiner.
Directed by Rob Reiner.
I was at a poker game with once.
Oh, really? I worked with Rob Reiner.
I worked with him today too. On what?
On the poker game? Were you?
No, I had one line in North. But the poker game was our older brother, Adam, Rob Reiner, Billy Crystal, Chris Guest, and Bruno Kirby.
Oh, it's like that kind of a poker game.
I did not say a word. I was 18. I just graduated from high school, and I was visiting Adam.
Right.
And he brought me to this poker game, and I sat there with my mouth shut the entire evening, trying not to mess myself.
That's a tough room. That's a really, really tough room.
Yeah.
I've been in a poker at a poker table that tough in a while. Joe Brancato has a question. What was the title of the play you did with your dad, Promenade? Oh. That was called Power Plays.
Power Plays. There we go. Oh, you don't have to type it back.
Oh, I don't. That's right. But he typed it. I'm getting used to this.
He's hearing you.
Yes, Power Plays. Yeah. Written by him and Elaine May.
Elaine May.
Yeah.
Okay. So you had some lead off for Misery.
Well, I mean, you know, my main question is, well, you actually picked the film and it was pretty like immediate. We thought about doing this. And we're like, well, what movie would we see? And you said, like, the first thing you said was Misery.
Yeah.
And it's not a very, like, nobody talks about it much anymore. It's still, people like it. But was it just a joke on the title? Like, everything is miserable now and we're going to be in misery and talking to each other and trying to get people to watch us talking. It's miserable. Is that what it was?
No, I don't. It wasn't conscious that way, but I think psychologically it's really interesting that right now, I've essentially been alone in an apartment. Basically, I am James Caan in that movie.
Yeah.
Minus the broken legs and Kathy Bates.
Right.
But I am trapped in an apartment and trying to write the sequel to my novel, and I'm miserable.
It's not a big surprise, really, when you think about it.
I cannot, because it's not like for years and years and years I've been saying to myself, oh my God, I have to see Misery.
No, and you've never mentioned it to me before, and we've never talked about it, like, as a movie. But I think it was a perfect pick, actually, because it's something everybody knows, but they don't really remember maybe very clearly.
Well, and the minute I posted that that's what we were going to be talking about, people, like, the first comment I got was somebody, my cousin Peter Birkenhead, also a brilliant actor and amazing writer, immediately posted, you dirty bird.
Yeah. Oh, I had several people talk about The Penguin, which was my friend Trish was like, I used to run around the house when I was a little girl saying the penguin was facing the wrong way. And my friend Don always says cock-a-doodie something. I mean, it's kind of seeped into the culture a little bit, you know?
I got really worried that that was a mistake.
that what was it?
The penguin being put down. I was like, if that was just a continuity mistake, I'm gonna kill somebody. That would be a nightmare.
So you picked Misery, a movie I hadn't seen it since it came out, and that's obviously dating myself because the movie came out in 1956, which put me at about 25 when I saw it. It wasn't something that really resonated. I mean, I liked it, but at that time in 1990, popular Hollywood movies kind of took over everybody. There weren't that many of them like there are now. It felt like you every season you had your one big movie.
Right. And
Misery had its moment where everybody talked about it. Everybody was talking about the hobbling scene, which we'll discuss. And it was kind of just in the air for a while. And then I hadn't seen it since 1990. So I literally hadn't thought of seeing it.
I have one observation about the film from a filmmaking. Well, I have several observations from a filmmaking standpoint, but I think that movie uses cross-cutting more than any film I've ever seen in my entire life.
Yeah.
To build, it constantly was going to a scene where she's doing something and he's doing something and he's going to, just back and forth, her face, his face, her feet in the snow, his legs in the wheelchair, over and over, cross-cutting that tension of will she get there before he gets back into the chair or something like that.
Yeah, that was just from a filmmaking perspective. I thought that sequence was fantastic. That really held up really well to me.
Yeah, really
well edited movie. Like, it's a super well edited movie. I need to be responsible here because I know some of the people that worked on the movie well were just mentioning the editing. Let's find out who did that, because I know it was a very well known editor, and I hate to leave. They're always just nobody thinks about editors. About the poor editors, guys. What about those people?
Can we have a shout out for the editors here? Give us a shout out for the editors.
They half the time they've really directed the movie, you know. Right.
While you're shouting out the editors, give this video a like.
While you're at it,
I put a little banner up there saying "Give this video a like." Is that
Oh, that's definitely it charges people up.
Yeah, I'm pandering. I like to pander. I have other things that banners that I'm going to show later. Very excited.
I'm looking forward to your creativity. So, he edited a lot of big movies. He edited a lot of Rob Reiner's movies.
Wait, who was it? Who's the editor?
The editor is Robert Lighten. I wasn't familiar with by name, but he edited all of Reiner's movies and then went on to do a lot of other stuff.
Did he edit North?
He edited North.
Then I worked with him.
You did. He knows more about your work than a lot of people because he's had to shape it and form it into it.
No shaping of my work. When an actor is in only one shot, the only decision the editor gets to make is in the movie or not in the movie.
That's a big shape though, if you keep it in. So you think of it that way.
Yeah.
This guy edited a lot of stuff. Also, let's talk about the crew while we're on it for a second. I mean, we had some great people, including Barry Sonnenfeld, who shot the movie.
Yeah.
Who then, right after this was over, went on to start directing and directed The Addams Family and all those series and Men in Black. But before this, he just shot stuff and was famous for shooting the Coen Brothers early movies. So his shooting style was very popular.
Okay. So before Roger Deakins started.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. He did Raising Arizona, I think, Barry Sonnenfeld, and Blood Simple, I think. What'd you think of the movie?
I loved it.
Yeah.
But you know me, and you know that I am a plot guy. And a mystery and suspense guy, and that the construct of the logic of the plot.
Yeah.
I have a question about something that I thought there was a hole.
Well, I don't believe you.
You don't believe me?
It can't be. It can't be possible that there's a hole in this film.
Not a hole, but a something that was fudged and that I think could have been addressed somehow, which is the rage that she feels at him starts when she reads the new book that he's just finished.
Yeah.
Because he killed Misery. Spoiler alert. There are going to be spoiler alerts.
We're going to give some stuff away. Yeah.
Actually, I didn't give that much away there. That, you know, we actually know that at the beginning of the movie. Because in the meeting with Lauren Bacall, another amazing actor who your wife has worked with.
Yes.
So she flies into a rage because he killed Misery, which is sort of the second inciting incident after the car accident of, now I'm going to make you stay here and write the new novel.
And for context, Misery is the main character of his novel series.
And so he starts writing the novel, and she comes in and reads his first few chapters and flies into a rage because she says it's all wrong. It has to start when Misery is buried in the ground and you have to explain why she's not actually dead. But if she burned that book and it never came out, then that book isn't part of the canon that he has to fix.
I think, though, that, well, okay, if that's the way it is, then you're right. That's a big hole. But I think
unless in
that
her
novel,
head.
That novel, that manuscript that he has in the beginning, is not a Misery book. She doesn't like that manuscript because it's not a Misery book and because it's filthy and he uses bad language in it. That's why she doesn't like that original manuscript. And that doesn't even have Misery in it. That's his breakout novel. That's the one that's going to change his whole career. Because he's finally breaking out. He's killed Misery. And that book is just going to come out. So he's finished writing Misery.
How does she find out about him killing Misery?
She buys the book. It comes out while he's in the bed.
I'm wrong.
You were technically wrong.
Completely wrong.
There's not a ton of clarity, and we could probably blame Stephen King on some of these things.
You know what? We have to start the show over again because I'm embarrassed now. Welcome to.
Personally would like to keep the show going with this already kind of established.
That I don't know what I'm talking about.
So, I do agree though that it's a bit confusing and a bit. Convenient that everything happens, that she's in the town he writes in, maybe she moved there because he writes there, but he's not there very often, so why would she have done that? And then
I'll accept that in the same way that I accept things like, you know, in I've had friends read friends who don't read detective novels.
Right.
Read a detective novel or other detective novels for the first time, and they say things like, well, but why does he even get involved?
Yeah.
And it's because that's what detectives do.
There's a tipping point where I feel like there's an acceptable amount of coincidence within the genre, and then a couple of too many of them and it starts to kind of
But why does she live in that town? Because if she lived in some other town where he didn't have the car accident, it would be a really boring movie.
I'll give you that. But I mean, like, add that to the fact that his book comes out while he's in the house with her.
Right.
It's a little bit much.
Yeah.
So you follow plot. That's big. That's, you're big on plot and
things. I said that I follow plot. I said that I follow plot. I think we've established that I don't do it very well.
I wanted to reinforce that for anybody listening. I generally don't follow plot as much as Alana. That's sweet. This is really, really love. You are accepting. Period. Yes. Well, you know, we're trying to make the best of a bad situation. And then by that I don't mean that being brothers with this guy is a bad situation. It's a good situation. But we're in lockdown and things are weird, so that's the bad situation. So. You loved it. You said flat out, you loved it.
I did love
it. Yeah, a little problem with that plot thing. Now that's fixed. You loved it.
I do have another question. There is, and this you will be able to answer and may show more of my filmmaking ignorance.
I like where this is going, just so you know.
Well, because in terms of film style, and cinematograph.
I'm gonna. cinematography.
Cinematographic technique. You are much more well versed than I am. There was an aspect to how, and this may just be because it was in the 90s, and I haven't watched a lot of 90s movies lately, right? It was 1990.
Yeah.
But there was an aspect to the look of it that, and maybe this was because it's Misery and he writes romance novels. There was an aspect to the look and the sort of the texture of it. That felt a little bit Hallmark movie-ish, if you know what I mean.
I totally agree with you. It's really funny because I was thinking that my only real complaint about the movie, and I hate saying any complaints about stuff because I really much rather focus on positive things, but I mean, it's a show. People want drama. They want to hear about things you don't like.
Yeah.
I thought the art direction and set design was actually pretty subpar. I was kind of disappointed. I know that was very professionally done. And the production design was by Norman Garwood, who has done amazing things. He did a movie. He did Brazil, which is one of my favorite movies and one of the best looking.
And incredible design.
One of the best looking movies. Yeah. Glory. Amazing looking film.
But that's why I'm wondering if it was a choice, because the novels are sort of Hallmark novels.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a choice, and I think it was also super brightly lit. A lot of it looked almost like a TV show. It was lit like really high key light, and everything looked like a set. But there was something about, I gotta say, like, everything looked like a set to me. And maybe that was on purpose, but I don't really feel the movie's trying to work at that level so much. I think The Shining came out, and I don't think Carl Reiner wanted to, like, compete with Kubrick. So he just was like, I'm gonna make, like, a normal movie. And I just felt like it was very kind of stage. It looked like a stage set. And in close-ups, all the hardware, doors, molding, looked like they just got it from Home Depot. It was kind of like weird.
All those close-ups of him unlocking,
brand new lock, like very pristine, and you could see this joins in the set and stuff. So there were things that I thought was weird on the design level too. Sonnenfeld lit it. I think he did. I think it was too bright. I think he put too much light on it. I think they were trying to be ironic about it's a horror movie, but it's brightly lit, kind of like The Shining. But I think it could have had a little more depth and menace to it if maybe it had been a little bit more realistic. And it wasn't just because it was the 90s. I mean, it was shot on films, technically very beautiful. Like, it's beautifully shot, really. But it, to me, it was a little out of keeping with the what I was hoping for the movie.
Okay. What did the movie, when you were watching it, make you want to eat? Because this is called Two Brothers Talk About Food in Movies, and we haven't talked about food at all. Well, and then we do have to circle back and tell some James Caan
stories. Yeah.
Nothing to do with Misery, but we did have some interesting intersections with James Caan.
We did. And Carl Reiner.
And
probably Francis Sternhagen at some point, too. But I don't remember, but it probably happened.
I went on a date with Francis. That's a whole other thing.
No. Okay. That's a different podcast. An After Hours podcast.
Yeah.
The big question is, like, everybody's going to ask. Like, it's going to be a burning question on everybody's minds. Are we talking about pairing food in movies? Is that the point?
No.
Right.
No, I think we should explain how this podcast, the origin story of the podcast, is that during the pandemic, one of the things that has gotten me through has been Zoom calls with you.
Yeah, right back at you.
Where we're just checking in with each other to make sure that we're okay. Because New York is spiking, LA is spiking,
right.
You're alone. Are you, how's mom? There's been a lot of taking care of each other.
Sure.
But after that 30 seconds of taking care of each other, it has devolved into, you know what I made yesterday.
Yeah. It's always one of the first things we talk about.
And have you seen this? Oh, dude, you have to see this.
Yep.
For instance, you gave me something that's actually really helping me survive the pandemic, because I can be freaking out and watching the news, and then bedtime comes and I know I'm never going to get to sleep because I can't unwind.
Right.
And I watch an episode of Still Game, which, for those of you who don't know it, it's a Scottish sitcom, and it is so heartwarming and silly and hostile and stupid and about people with tiny little meaningless lives and how meaningful those can be, that one half hour episode of that helps me get to sleep.
Yeah.
So our conversations have just always circled around food and movies.
Yeah. Which, yeah. For all our lives.
Really. All our lives. Yeah.
We watched movies together. We ate dinners together, and we talked about dinner and the movies. And that was what we did. And
that's basically how we spent our lives growing up, was talking about movies at the dinner table or making dinner and going into the TV room with mom and dad, Adam and, and Jimmy, the dog.
Jimmy the dog, who was a gift from James Caan.
You'll tell that story. And watching a movie and talking about it. And, you know, for those of you who don't know, you know, a friend was at one of those dinners once and afterwards said, wow, that was really intense. And I said, why? And they said, because when you guys watch movies, it's business.
Yeah. So why did that guy get to be in that movie?
Yeah.
Why is that guy in a movie?
Yeah. It was serious business watching movies growing up in our family.
Yeah. Yeah. It was intense.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, I'm a movie nut. I mean, big time. And every childhood memory is anchored by a movie or a time period when a movie came out. It defines my growing up. Like a lot of people, you know, but with us having a dad who did it for a living and then traveling with him and watching these things get made and then kind of starting to become actors and in the business very young, because we both started very young.
Yeah.
How old were you when you started? I forget.
I did my first job, which was People Suit.
Oh, right.
Which was from a short story, you know, but for people who don't, it was a short story that our father wrote when he was in high school, and he wrote it about his younger brother and younger sister were the characters, and when he was an adult and he was starting to want to direct movies, he thought he would direct a short, and so he rewrote People Soup about, made it two boys instead of a brother and sister, he made it about two brothers. And he cast me and Adam. I was 8. Adam was 11. It was 1968. And we shot it in 3 days. And that was my first SAG gig.
Can I share a screen briefly for a second?
Sure.
Can you see that?
Yeah, it's not you, it's not primary. Oh, wait, let me add it to the stream. You have to, oh yeah, it's, I'll make it, bigger somehow.
Well,
yeah, there you go. That's, me at 8 years old and Adam.
That is Matthew, my brother.
Oh, wow. You're actually showing it.
Well, there's a preview.
You better freeze. Freeze it quick because you're about to give a big spoiler. Woo!
Okay. Well, that's you. And stop screen.
Yeah.
There we go. We're back.
That was me at 8 years old. I have a picture of you here that you sent.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Should we share that?
Well, sure. Why not?
Later.
Let's do it. Let's wrap up why we're talking about Jimmy Kahn.
Okay. Talking about Jimmy Kahn. Oh wait, no, not this is a different one. So we'll come back.
Right.
So screen share. We want to start with. There we go.
There it is.
Wrong one. The heck is going on? Stop sharing. Screen share. Application. Da, da, da. Come on, you bastard. What are you seeing?
I'm seeing
the right one. Okay.
I see us. Little thumbnails, and I see the picture. So
yeah. So that's,
what's going on here? Wow,
that's. I think you're being auctioned off for a very rare dish served in certain restaurants.
It looks like Dad lost a bet to Jimmy Kahn.
That's you and Jimmy.
All this is probably slightly confusing. The backstory is our dad, who's holding me in this picture. I'm a little kid, obviously, because this is in the 70s. I'm not that old. So that's James Kahn and my dad, and the owner of a very famous at the time restaurant in San Francisco. And they were making a film together, and they used to go to that restaurant every week and have a big meal with the whole production and stuff.
There's a meal that I remember from there. We'll keep going.
The duck in paper thing that everybody talked about?
Melon. A melon.
Okay. It's okay, man.
A melon. That looked like a whole melon that had been roasted. And it's like, oh, a melon, amazing. And you cut it open, and there was a duck inside.
So the melon's, it's a whole intact melon. So you're like, how?
Intact melon. How did they get the duck in there?
You're like, duck come like that? What's happening?
Yeah.
I kind of vaguely remember the stories about that place. But anyway, so Pop was working with James Caan, and he during the course of the filming, they got along really well. And James Caan bought him and the family a dog, completely unasked for, not something that they, my, you know, our folks had asked him to do. And there was this dog, and they thought about turning him back to the pet, like giving him back, because they were traveling in San Francisco. And 2 days later, I had fallen completely in love with the dog, and they were like, they couldn't separate it. So they named the dog Jimmy. And so the dog growing up was a gift from Jimmy Caan, which is unusual to me even today. I don't even know how to relate to that.
I don't know if you remember this part of it, but Jimmy was supposed to be a collie because Dad had always wanted a collie. Right. And so Jimmy bought him a collie. And we kept going, this doesn't look like
a collie. Doesn't look like he's turned. As a puppy, he kind of looked like a collie. And then he grew up a little bit and it was clear he wasn't.
And then it turned out that the woman, the breeder, called Jimmy Caan and said there was a problem. Some other dog had jumped the fence. And Jimmy wanted to take Jimmy back.
Right.
Because he wanted to replace him with a real collie for Dad. But by that point, you had fallen in love with him. And they're like, no, we're not giving him up.
He was a great dog. Let's face it. He was fantastic.
And I'm not a dog. I hate to admit this, but you know this horrible fact about me, that I'm not a dog person. And I loved Jimmy.
He was a good one. He was a good one. So anyway, that's the story of Jimmy. And that's one of the reasons why Misery was kind of cool, because I vaguely remember James Caan. It was very nice. I was a little kid, but he was very nice to me. I found it a little bit difficult to believe that James Caan ever wrote anything. That might have been the only thing about Misery that I didn't
believe about the movie. Yeah,
I didn't really believe he knew maybe how to use a typewriter except to throw it at somebody.
Particularly since part of the character development at the beginning of the movie that never pays off is. He goes outside and there's snow and he makes a snowball and he throws it and it hits the target and he goes, yeah, still got it. It's like, okay, so we've established that this guy is a jock.
Yeah.
What about
the typing stuff? Right. And when we have James Caan there, you don't really have to do anything to establish that he's a jock, because clearly he's a jock. I mean, the guy looks like a jock.
Yeah.
My only real complaint about it, I think he's great in the movie and he gets beaten up fantastic. Like he gets beaten up better than anybody except maybe Marlon Brando.
Yeah. And dies pretty well too. The causeway scene.
You have a story about that scene from The Godfather, as I recall.
Well, I just remember him talking about it was when Dad was getting wired up to be shot in Freebie and the Bean, because he gets shot at the end of it.
This is back when they used to do squibs and actually have explosives on people. Yeah.
Yeah. So they're wiring Dad up for to get shot. And I really, you know, one of the things I always wanted to do was I always wanted to be there to watch the cool stuff that was going to happen. So I wanted to watch Dad get shot. How often do you get to watch your dad get shot?
Let's not say anything more.
I'm calling my therapist in the morning. But they're wiring Dad up, and Jimmy is talking about it, because I don't think Dad had been shot in anything before. And Jimmy was talking about being what it felt like shooting the causeway scene in The Godfather.
Boy, oh boy, was he shot in a movie.
And with squibs just all over his body and, you know, him just feeling them go off because they're little explosives. But then the funny thing about the learning about film and how I had I do this other show called Tips and Techniques for Actors, Authors, and Storytellers. Last week, I was interviewing our friend Bo Baker, who's a sound man, and he used a metaphor for the making of movies that I'd never heard before that I thought was really brilliant. And he said this thing about how, you know, people come to film sets and they see 100 people standing around doing nothing. And he said, think about, you know, Henry Ford and the Ford Motor Company, which has a production line. and everybody, you know, puts their one piece on the car, and a car, you know, cars are rolling down that assembly line. And if it's your job to put the rear view mirror on, I put a rear view mirror on, another car comes, I put a rear view mirror on, another car comes, and a car rolls off the assembly line every 3 minutes.
Right.
He said, a movie is exactly the same way, but there's one car.
That's brilliant.
You're only that's making really one. So that you need an incredible amount of expertise for your job.
Yeah.
So you've done it for that shot, you're done, and you have to wait for the next shot.
So,
what was I talking about? Oh, the squib. Oh, so this was one of the early lessons I got on how the incredible amount of knowledge and ability that each job on a film set has is. I sat in the makeup trailer, the special effects and wardrobe trailer, watching Dad get squibbed up, and they put an undershirt on him. They put padding, they put the metal plate, they put the squib, they run the wire, they put the blood pack over the squib, they put the shirt and tie on, right? So, and they're explaining everything to him, as they do, and to me, because I'm only 13 years old. And we go out, and the shot is set up, and the camera starts to roll, and Dad and Jimmy come reaching up in their car. The suspect is there. Dad gets up. They approach the suspect, and Dad says, "Hey, hey," or whatever. And the woman, or the is a transvestite character, pulls out the gun and shoots Dad, and I go for him because I'm, you know, it's just a reaction.
For Dad or the shooter?
For Dad, I go, because he falls back against the car,
right.
And I see blood, and I go. And the moment I start to move, very big, strong arms anchor me from both sides, and I can't move an inch.
Right.
And afterwards, I found out that the first AD found two of the biggest guys on the crew and said, "Go stand next to Matthew during the shot, because when Alan gets shot, he's gonna go."
Wow. And you did.
And check this out. My friend Joel Roos, who lives up in
That's absolutely true.
Tommy Toy.
Toy, you're absolutely right. That name just totally came back to me.
He's still there. And the next time I come up to visit you, can we go there for a meal? Those are my questions for you, Joel.
That would be something.
I remember
his restaurant was very high up, like in a penthouse or something.
Something like that, in
the middle of Chinatown. It was amazing. How cool. By the way, they call that child abuse now. I don't know if you know that. You were abused by people on the Hollywood set, and you need to come to grips with that, man.
Which part of it was abuse? Getting to watch my dad get shot?
All of it. All of that was terribly abusive.
Don't get me started. What are James Bond's story for? Well, okay. While we're on child abuse.
Terrible topic, but what did you have?
I turned 13 during the shooting of Freebie and the Bean.
Uh-huh.
And I'm on set, and Jimmy finds out it's my 13th birthday and says, "Let me take him out for lunch for his birthday."
Uh-oh.
And Dad's like, "Sure, take him out for lunch for his birthday." And Jimmy took me to the San Francisco Playboy Club.
Wow. You know,
that was my bar mitzvah. Today I am a man.
Well, James Caan is Jewish, so that's an official bar mitzvah.
Yeah, that was my bar mitzvah.
Yeah,
I never realized that.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
I feel a little, I mean, Adam has some stories from the old days too. The boogie down 60s and 70s of the, yeah. of the, well, I missed out on a little bit of the ribaldry, as they say.
Ribaldry. We're going to have him on here. We're going to change the name to Three Brothers Talk About Food and Movies. If I can't make it and he can't make it and you do the show alone, you'll call it One Brother Talks About
Food. One of these brothers will be doing something for everybody's viewing entertainment.
Yeah.
Trying to think if there was anything else about the movie before we jump on to food. Where was my notes on this?
Well, you know, one transition to the food, though. I do have a transition from the movie to the food.
Yes.
When we're done talking about your stuff about the movie.
Not for nothing, William Goldman. Very tight, fun script. Definitely. One of the greats. Interesting thing, the only thing in the movie that doesn't translate anymore. Liberace. Nobody knows what Liberace, no one's listened to Liberace in so long. The joke worked in the 90s because even like kids might have heard their grandparents listening to Liberace. They knew the right. reference. You look at that now and then they put some Liberace records on like as a comment on the scene. And you don't, nobody knows what that is now.
Right.
So it's a bit of a joke that doesn't play.
Yeah.
I really loved Kathy Bates in this. I have to say props to her. Great. I think just a really iconic performance.
And she won the Academy Award?
She did. She won the Academy Award for that, which oddly wasn't listed on IMDb. I can't believe that IMDb is got some faulty information.
That's crazy.
Can you imagine that?
That's crazy.
What to do? So we're not talking about pairing food and movies in this. That's not the point. The
transition to food from that movie is that there is a lot of food in that movie, and it sucks.
Well, it looks like hospital food. She like makes hospital food for him.
Yeah. So it looks like. There's nothing appealing about the food in that
movie. Not at all. However, my friend Peter asked if Frick, he was saying, well, did you have some charcuterie with the misery? Like as if that would be a good pairing. And I was like, well, that's disgusting. And I get it. And I love that. But no. However, I think I may have outdone that because I think I actually did do the correct pairing, though not last night. We watched the movie last night, had a really terrible dinner. I'm going to completely confess. I chumped out. I was tired. It was just a cursory, slightly depressing example of a dinner. It was like Amelia and I looked at each other and we were like, it's food. It's going to fill us up. Let's not, you know, have it be any more than that.
Oh, sorry.
But today worked out. And okay. Today's pairing would have been a great pairing because I think that roast chicken, where you have to maybe break a leg off or whatever, is the perfect
thing for that. Yeah.
And that's what I made tonight. So I'm kind of feeling like that.
Okay.
It's
well,
close enough time.
As we talk about more food, I'm gonna throw another banner up. For a second.
All right.
Subscribe to my newsletter, which the link to subscribe to the newsletter should be in the comments below this video, in the comments section, and you will not only get my newsletter, but you will get the link to a secret page on my website that will have recipes for the things that we talk about on the show, as well as other tidbits. So that's pretty damn exciting. I don't know how exciting that is, but
if you like food and you like us, it would be a great thing.
So here's something that I made. I don't know if I ever spoke to you about. And it's something that one would make if you had a really nice romantic, like your first romantic overnight with somebody, perhaps, maybe you would make this in the morning to really try and show.
Oh, this is a breakfasty thing. Okay.
How romantic and sensitive you were. Do you know about cloud eggs?
No.
So,
Wait, do this eggs you add like baking soda to and they turn into like fluffy eggs or something?
No.
Whoa. What is happening?
So,
I thought you said cloud eggs. These are clown eggs.
Clown eggs. Cloud eggs are what you do is you crack the eggs and separate the yolks and the whites.
Right.
You put the yolks in little individual dishes.
And then you mix the whites with something else, cheese or...
you whip them. You beat them so they're almost like meringue. They're big, puffy air. And then you make little mounds of them on parchment paper on a baking sheet. And make a little divot. But you can add your spices to them and whatever. And then you put the yolks in and then you bake it. And the whites bake like a nice soft meringue and the yolks get... And if you like your yolks runny, you can bake the whites
what you want. You can have the egg you want instead of being forced to have the egg that a chicken decided you're supposed to have.
Right. But it doesn't really taste much different than it's a little less greasy than a fried egg. It's lighter.
Well, now I'm confused because it's a lot of work for something to taste the same, kind of the same as an egg.
No, but it's that's why I said after a romantic evening.
I gotcha. You want to impress them? I really
elegant presentation.
I really care about you. I'm going to spend some time like making this thing. Yeah. All right.
If you want it to be really like wacky bird nutso,
like dirty bird crazy. Yeah.
If you get some really amazing bread and toast it lightly and maybe put a little prosciutto and cheese. Done. A little prosciutto and cheese on there and throw it under the grill, under the water, right? And then put the cloud eggs on top of that. Go kill yourself.
You have a little caponata on the side, maybe?
Yeah, Dad would say, walk away.
Walk away. Get out of here. That he'd say that too. Get out of here. Yeah, that sounds pretty fantastic. You have been focused seemingly on breakfast things for a while. When we talk about food, you've been like, oh, I made a breakfast, like a bread, jalapeno bread, breakfast bread. And I made you made a lot of breakfast stuff.
You mean like that?
Look at that.
That is in a pan that you gave me for Christmas.
Yeah. We can't really talk about food anymore without talking about cast iron. It's become obsessional. So you gave
me that pan, and that is jalapeno, green chili cheddar beer bread made in the cast iron pan. And it's
well done.
And that, in the morning, heated up with fried eggs on top of it is...
Come on.
Just kill yourself.
I was pleased with what I made tonight.
Tell me this chicken.
Well, I did a chicken in the Instant Pot. A whole chicken pressure cooked, which I only done once before, and I really liked it. I tried it again, tried to perfect it a little bit. That Instant Pot is actually pretty damn cool. And it's like the tenderest chicken you've ever had. It's amazing. Have you done that yet?
I have. Chicken? Yeah. What do you do about the skin?
You brown it. I brown it first in the Instant Pot because you can saute on saute mode. And then you brown it on all sides for about 5 minutes.
Oh, okay.
And then And then I don't think about it anymore.
Okay. Because I did a thing, you know, living alone in the pandemic, cooking is a little odd because you think stews because I can freeze them, but I don't want to make a, you know, lots of stuff. It's like, it's got to be something I can either eat the whole thing without turning into Orson Welles or freeze well. But I discovered that in the Instant Pot, you can cook Cornish game hens from frozen.
Right? In less than the time it takes to make a piece of toast.
Yeah. So you put a little broth or water in there and put the herbs and stuff and rub the frozen game hen with some stuff and put it on the trivet and pressure cook it. And then when it's done, I take it out and spatchcock it. Because of tight.
Stop that. Or explain yourself.
You know, cut it and
split it open so it's flat. Yes, thank you. It's
called spatchcocking.
They really should come up with a different name.
Yeah, they should. And then you put it on a baking sheet and throw it under the broiler for like 3 minutes to the skin.
So you got your quick. When? What do you do for lunch? What do you do for food? I am going to share, if I can screen share. You screen shared very elegantly, I must say. I apparently was a very ugly mess, and I apologize. Well,
when you go to screen share, you'll see that there's full screen, and then there's application share. You see the thing that says application share?
I just see screen share. That's all I see.
Yeah, but hit screen share.
Oh.
And then you'll see something that says application share.
It just says share screen.
Oh.
I don't think I can do it if I didn't set up the meeting.
All right.
But you saw my desktop, right?
Yeah.
Share screen. It all went mad. Okay, I'm sharing. You see that?
Oh yeah.
So this is something I've wanted to make for a while. And
wait, I have to add it to the stream. There we go. It's in the stream now. What is that?
That is what the recipe calls cooked to death vegetables. And I saw this recipe and I was like, I gotta try this out. This sounds very death metal and I love that. So it's cooked to death vegetables. That is Lacinto kale. Is that how you pronounce it? Dinosaur kale and celery. And the idea is that you take a Dutch oven or a cast iron skillet with a top on it. And you cook this stuff, olive oil, garlic, red pepper flakes, salt, on the lowest heat that you can do for like 2 hours. And it just turns into like another thing. And flavors that weren't there before start to come up. It's fantastic. Highly recommend that.
Wow.
So that was good. I'll show you. I'll pull up another picture of the whole shebang. I won't bore everybody with minute details, but all right, here's the whole plated dinner.
Wow.
So that's the chicken is really great done in the Instant Pot. Don't be scared of it. It's fantastic. Those are mashed potatoes that I just can't get enough of. Little baby white, like waxy potatoes. Cut them up, boil them for about 10 minutes, mash them up with olive oil, salt, pepper, and a little bit of lemon juice and chopped up scallions. And you serve at room temperature. And it's like, you just want your brain to just stop. You just want to stop and freeze that moment in time.
Wow. Yeah.
Good stuff.
Wow.
So it's all about cast iron skillets, folks. It's about movies and cast iron. Movies, I think clear
skillets and instant pots. Apparently, we like those.
Very good, but you can cook a chicken in an instant in a cast iron skillet if you spatchcock it first.
Yeah. So we need to talk about what are we going to watch for next week, for next week.
Well, I mean, do we want to involve everybody in this? This seems like it could get ugly and personal. And
then we'll decide later this evening.
Let's talk a little bit about parameters, maybe. At least a little bit, because maybe somebody would, you know, type in or email us like an idea or a suggestion if we talk about what we might be looking for. We don't really want to do new movies, right? We're looking at...
We want to look at older movies.
Like from the 90s backwards, right? Maybe you're... Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Although, you know, I'll watch Love Actually anytime.
I'll watch it, but I don't want to comment on it because if we all start working again, I don't want to alienate people who are currently working in the business and say what I actually think about the movies.
Okay. All right.
I don't think that...
You want to stop your screen share, maybe.
Oh, I thought I had.
Well, I took it out of the stream, but there we go.
So, this is going to be films from the 90s and before is what we're talking about. Do you want to stick with films that like American films? Do you want to do international? Do you want to do like films that were like kind of hits, like Misery as a template? Or off the beaten track a little bit.
We can go both ways. I think we can do whatever we want.
This isn't a very scintillating conversation if it's going to be just whatever we want. We have to stick to some kind of parameter.
Some kind of parameters. Well, what we originally talked about was a movie that one of us hadn't seen, but that's going to be hard to do. I think that would devolve into a movie that I haven't seen.
You've seen
every movie.
I've seen a lot of movies, I'm not gonna lie. But I hadn't seen Misery in a long time, so it was great to revisit. I just think it should be something we're both like happy to revisit that maybe we might have a different opinion now about than we did before.
Right. You know what I have not seen in maybe 40 years? Maltese Falcon.
Well, I would watch that movie any day of the week, and you can't.
Is that a good one for this?
It's how can we go wrong? It's the Maltese Falcon. It's John Huston. It's John Huston's first movie. It's one of the earliest examples of like a classic detective film.
Any stories about people we know in the Maltese Falcon?
I dated Mary Astor for a while when I was very young.
Yeah. No, the closest we're going to get to a story about the Maltese Falcon is that your wife worked with somebody who was married to Humphrey Bogart.
Right, right. And so did Adam.
So did Adam.
With that same person, so that's true. But she's not in this movie.
I had dinner with her.
Well, you would, if you haven't seen it in a while, it's wonderful. So we should definitely consider that as an option.
My friend Sid is recommending L.A. Story.
That's another cool one I haven't seen since it came out.
And I've never seen it.
I remember being a really charming, very funny movie.
Okay. So should we do L.A. Story next week?
Let's do L.A. Story, yeah.
There we go. Thank you, Sid.
That's great. Thank you for that recommendation.
Sid. LA Story next week. So as a reminder, subscribe to my newsletter and get these recipes. LA Story next week. We will be back Wednesday at 7 Pacific, 10 Eastern. And also, for those of you who are film students or into the technical side of film, Monday at 1 o'clock Pacific, 4 o'clock Eastern, I am going to have as my guest on Matthew Arkin Studio Tips and Techniques for Actors, Authors, and Storytellers, cinematographer Attila Saleh, who was the cinematographer on Get Shorty, Aquarius, Mayans MC, Justified. He's shot episode after episode after episode after episode.
Those were great looking shows. Those were all really good looking shows.
And wow. He's actually in prep right now to start directing. Once production comes back, he's going to start directing. It's a Netflix show that is Society, which is shooting in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going to speak. He will answer questions about any aspect of cinematography. But primarily for my acting students, he will be talking about things that actors need to know about cinematography. But also, I believe a lot of my students from Chapman, hopefully, will be joining in to ask questions that he may be able to give them about cinematography. He's a really lovely man. I've worked with him on both Aquarius and Get Shorty, and he's really terrific. So
that sounds great.
Well, this was just a blast.
I had a great time.
Well, it was sort of like what we do anyway.
It's a little bit more like pressure. I feel like I'm a little like backstage, and this is a terrible like the dressing room is bad and the stage management is all over the place. It's a disaster, but this has been fun. End with one thing, because I realized the one thing I didn't say about Misery is, do you have one specific favorite thing from the movie? Because I know I have mine, which is a clear knockout 100 for me. It has one thing in it that's the best that's ever been in any movie, as far as I'm concerned.
I don't remember the actual line, but it was the moment where he kind of plays along with her.
Okay.
And it's sort of like, well, but...
At the dinner table? You mean like when they're having dinner together?
No, when he's in bed and he realizes, I better play along a little bit with this or things could
go really badly. There are plenty of great moments like that. Yeah. I'm talking about one thing, and it's a design element, and it's a thing that's just the best that it's ever been for me in any movie ever. And I'll tell you what it is. It's his book jacket author photograph. Paul Sheldon's photograph of the character Paul Sheldon is the best author photograph I've ever seen in a movie. It's perfect. So that's what I have.
That's what you want to end on.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you all for joining us. I hope you guys had as much fun as we did.
And if you didn't, we're still coming back for more. So it's tough luck
anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you liked this or not,
you can't stop this love. You can't stop us from hanging out. So don't cry.
Thanks for tuning in. Don't forget to subscribe to this channel and click the bell icon so that you get notifications of all of our upcoming live streams, and like this video, and we will see you again next week. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks everybody.
Two brothers talk about food and movies. Good night.
Good night, guys. Bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Arkin Brothers Talk About Movies. That's my brother, Matthew Arkin.
And that's my brother, Anthony Arkin. And we are interesting, irreverent,
and irrelevant. But you can follow us on Instagram anyway. You can also subscribe to our newsletter and check out our merch.
And you can do it all on our website. Just follow the link on your podcast app.
If you want to know more about Matthew, like if you want to stalk him or something, you can learn more than you'd ever want to know at MatthewArkin.com.
And if you're a fan of my kid brother, Anthony, you can find him at Clem Torment on Instagram.